When President Obama refers to the Saudi Arabia of coal, he's not talking about West Virginia or Wyoming, but his home state of Illinois. Jeff Biggers can trace his roots to the Eagle Creek area, the heart of mining in Illinois for centuries, first for salt and then coal. After he moved away to write stories about other places, Jeff Biggers returned to Eagle Creek to look into the impact of strip mining on his family's homestead. He visited this show in February to discuss his book, Reckoning at Eagle Creek, The Secret Legacy of Coal in the Heartland, and we thought that we would rebroadcast that interview for you today. I began by asking him, since, as I understand it, most of the coal produced in the United States is mined in western surface mines, especially in Wyoming's Powder River Basin, when President Obama calls Illinois the Saudi Arabia of coal, is he just expressing pride in his home state?
You know, I think that's a great point. 40% of our coal, in fact, comes from Wyoming and the Powder Basin there. But I think the truth
is... One mine produces more than all of Pennsylvania, if I understand correctly.
Exactly. Even sort of dwarfs the whole juggernaut of Appalachia. But President Obama cut his teeth in the whole coal fields in southern Illinois as a young legislator from Chicago. He came down in 1997, and that's where he heard for the first time this great phrase, the Saudi Arabia of coal, which is really one of the great mythologies we have, of course.
Well, how long has mining been going on in the area?
Well, in fact, coal was discovered in Illinois by the French in the 1600s, and so we go all the way back to the earliest industry. The French brought in 500 African slaves in 1702, and we really haven't looked back. The coal industry in Illinois has gone full blast really up until the 1990s.
It's kind of shocking to think that there was slavery in Illinois, the state of Lincoln.
You know, I think that's really one of the great secrets that I uncovered is that, of course, the coal industry began with slavery in Virginia with the Americans in the 1740s and 50s. In fact, the French philosopher Rochefoucauld, when he came to Thomas Jefferson, he couldn't believe that Jefferson would allow slaves to have harnesses around their necks and their waist dragging, working like human bulldozers and dying like flies. But even worse, it was dragged into Illinois. And in fact, our Constitution in 1818 said, of course, we're a great emancipationist state, but there was one little loophole that said, because we got our tax revenues, our biggest tax revenues, from the salt industry, which is fueled by the coal industry, they would allow legal slavery in Illinois, and in particular, my little holler.
So salt mining and coal mining were pretty much conducted in the same area?
Often it would go hand in hand, because in order to get the salt, you had to boil it. And, of course, they deforested the area quite quickly. So be it in West Virginia or the big salt areas of Ohio and Indiana and then eventually Illinois, which became really the major window to the west, you really needed coal to coal and boil that salt to process it.
Do salt and coal develop coincidentally?
Yeah, often as minerals, you find the two together throughout the country. In fact, Thomas Jefferson, when he sent Lewis and Clark west, you know, we forget the fact that they were not just there to discover the Western territories, but to make an inventory of these great mineral resources. And in fact, Captain Lewis said in southern Illinois, oh my God, this is some of the richest outcroppings of both salt and coal in the nation.
Well, wasn't it a starting off point, southern Illinois, for westward expansion?
In fact, Lewis and Clark departed from southern Illinois. And it really was the great window to the west for Thomas Jefferson and eventually the rest of the pioneers in expansion.
How have the people of the area been described by writers over the years?
You know, probably no other region outside of Appalachia has been so maligned as southern Illinois. Of course, when we think of Illinois, we think of Chicago and Al Capone and corn. We never think about the fact that a third of the state is the coal fields. Part of my research was to find that those of us who grew in this coalfield area is those who are from the backwoods, this incredible little shiny hills that stretches at the bottom third of the region, have always been written off with these stereotypes as sort of poor hillbillies who don't matter. And I found this kind of criminalization of the rural culture often went hand in hand with the strip mining and basically the abuse of the coal miners.
There was moonshining in the area, wasn't there?
Oh, of course, you know, and moonshining is wonderful. Moonshine was an indicator of two things, that you had great pure springs like in Eagle Creek, we had great pure water, and that you had hardwood forest. And so when the strip mines came in and completely destroyed our creeks and streams, you know, there's no more water in Eagle Creek, a famous place for springs, and destroyed the hardwood forest. And when the last moonshiner disappeared, we really knew the end of the forest had taken place.
But for many years, I am assuming, the coal mining was done in the usual, the old-fashioned underground mines. When did strip mining come to the area?
Well, strip mining actually got its birth in Illinois in the 1850s. They brought in horses and scrapers. And just slowly it began to progress. In the 1920s, of course, we had the steam power shovels, the same thing that built the Panama Canal. They dragged to southern Illinois, and we had a horrific massacre about it. But it didn't really get its groove in terms of the industry. Right now, it provides 60% of our coal until really about the 1950s, and that's when strip mining went off on steroids.
What's the history of your family in Eagle Creek?
You know, my family came in as missionaries and as pioneers in the early 1800s, over 200 years ago. And they went into the backwoods for two reasons. They are both looking as part of a woodlands culture to continue what they had brought from Appalachia. And they're also trying to establish some of the earliest historic communities around the salt wells. And so we are very much a part of the development of the salt industry. My grandfather was a coal miner who suffered from black lung disease, who barely survived a cave-in and an explosion. And he often showed me that so much of our incredible woods culture in southern Illinois went hand in hand with this historic development, that there was this secret legacy that I really needed to go back and discover that was very, very much a part of the crossroads of the American experience.
But outside of the mining, you say when your ancestors wanted coal, they just simply dug on the homestead, dug a little hole?
You know, Eagle Creek was...
Was it cold that close to the surface?
Yeah, it really was. And also, everybody had their little sort of, we called gopher mines or dog mines right into the hills. You know, it's one of these hilly areas. Once again, the Wisconsin Glacier didn't get to this part of southern Illinois. And so it's really the bridge between the Appalachian Mountains and the Ozarks. You have this gorgeous shiny hills, you know, 1,100 species of flora and fauna. And you had these wonderful nooks and crannies where you had coal. We had so much coal, Leonard, that my uncle would throw the scrap coal to the pigs. And, of course, he said that's how you got pork roast.
Did you ever live in Eagle Creek?
I never did. You know, I would visit my grandparents and cousins. Our last cousin lived there up until 1999. He had put on the front porch of the log cabin, 150-year-old log cabin that my mother grew up with. And he is waiting to have our ninth generation of our family live there when finally, one by one, the strip miners came in and pushed him out, forced him out, and completely destroyed Eagle Creek.
What tactics did those companies use to get people to give up their land?
You know, it's absolutely legally authorized terrorism to a certain point because they are given the permits to put off explosives now. And once again, with strip mining, we're allowed to use ammonium nitrate fuel oil explosives, 2,000 pounds within 700 feet of people living. And so they shook the house, it shook the frames, the dishes shot off. Eventually, they broke my cousin's well. You know, they made life unlivable. Fly rock came smashing through the windows and whatnot. And this was all legally authorized.
And did they give him a fair price, at least, for the land?
They gave him a fair price, but what is a fair price for nine generations of your family?
One of your chapters is titled 4.5 Hours. What does that mean?
There was 1 million tons of coal underneath our homestead. Seems like a lot, doesn't it? And when I really began to do my research, I thought, oh, my God, they took so much coal from our historic homestead. But when we did the math, Leonard, that was enough coal to generate power in America for 4.5 hours. That 200 years of an incredible legacy, an incredible important history dating back to indigenous people, was wiped out for 4.5 hours of electricity.
Is there any more coal in the land?
Yeah, they're still strip mining today. My cousin, who was pushed off the land, moved 10 miles up the road, and I just heard from him last week that Peabody has opened another strip mine and dust has already reached his new front porch.
Can the old homestead be returned to farming?
No. Less than 3% of strip mine land has ever been returned to any kind of productive use. You know, not only do they destroy this incredibly diverse flora and fauna, but because of loopholes in the reclamation laws, they're able to just to plant this kind of unmanaged grasslands. You know, not only did we lose our great forest and our great history, but we lost any sense of use of the land. It just sits there now like a battlefield.
What does it look like? What does strip mining do to a farm?
Right. The first look when I went there in 1999 for my mother and did a program for NPR was I really thought I was looking at an earthquake that it hit. You know, this rocks and rubble and mud, it just was completely devastated. This 200-foot amphitheater of death right there in front of me. It was mind-blowing. And then when I went back now, I've gone back so much over the past 10 years to really understand what we lost. It's just been replaced with this kind of grasslands that looks like some sort of unmanaged cemetery, really.
You talk about coal mining as ethnic cleansing. What do you mean by that?
You know, especially with mountaintop removal, which is the process of blowing up mountains in West Virginia. We often just talk about the birds and the bees. Oh my, we've lost 500 mountains in Appalachia. And of course, these lights and electricity here in our studios in New York City come from coal strip mine from West Virginia. But like in West Virginia and Illinois, this has created the largest forced removal of American citizens since the mid-19th century, that people are pushed off their ancestral land, their historic land, and they're actually forced out of the region. And that in my case in particular, you know, not only did they strip our land, but they stripped some very precious prehistoric Native American sites. They stripped a black cemetery where legal slavery had been operating in the coal mines nearby, and that my family had allowed African Americans to be buried. They completely stripped away our history as if it never existed. And to me, that's an element of historicide.
And have people been writing histories, or did you have to rely on people like Barry Bush to find out what had happened?
I had to go to Mr. Bush, who, of course, was an indigenous person who lived in the backwoods and had to tell me the story that, hey, no one knows this, but the Shawnee Indians never went away. We had a little community, just like the Cherokee, North Carolina. I had to go talk to coal miners and historians. I had to talk to Baptist historians. I had to go and talk to a lot of backwoods people still, you know, tucked away. And, of course, go to the original historical documents. It was one of these real reclamation projects.
Another person you consulted was Ron Nelson.
Ron Nelson was amazing. Here's this gun-toting evangelical, you know, the kind of person we often would think would be an enemy of environmentalists. But this person believed that you should protect cemeteries, and he was a Baptist minister. And he was one of the few people who was strong enough to stand up to big coal companies and say, hey, this is wrong. You shouldn't be destroying cemeteries.
Well, you mentioned the backwoods Baptists. They'd been fighting slavery, salt and coal traders for a long time.
Exactly. And I think this is part of the debunking the stereotypes. You know, we think of these backwood Baptists as moonshiners and feuding and fighting. And that's all we were told about Eagle Creek, of course. You know, we didn't have electricity till the 1950s. It's just a bunch of fighting hillbillies. But in truth,
in Illinois, you didn't have electricity until the 50s?
Not in Eagle Creek. Eagle Creek provided coal for Chicago to have electricity in the 1890s, but we didn't get it until 1952.
Wow.
But what was important is these backwood hillbillies, so-called, not only took on the slave owners, but they took on the coal companies using slaves. And they had based their church on what was called the Friends of Humanity, this amazing anti-slavery movement that was very important to make sure that Illinois kept up its legacy as an anti-slavery state.
My guest is Jeff Biggers, the American Book Award-winning author of The United States of Appalachia and In the Sierra Madre. He's worked as a writer, radio correspondent, and educator in the United States, Europe, India, and Mexico. Now writes regularly for the Huffington Post, among other publications. His latest book is Reckoning at Eagle Creek, The Secret Legacy of Coal in the Heartland. It's published by Nation Books, which is an imprint of Perseus Books. We will continue our conversation after this. I wanted to remind you that we're conducting a listener contest, judged by our word maven, Patricia T. O'Connor. We're asking you to take pictures of signs that don't make sense, whether they misspell or misuse a word, have bad grammar, or put punctuation in the wrong place. Just go to our show page to submit your photo by July 16th, and Pat will select her favorites, and then we'll reveal the winners on Wednesday, July 21st. For more information and some inspiration, go to our show page at WNYC.org. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're back with an interview I did in February with Jeff Biggers. He was on the show to discuss his book, Reckoning at Eagle Creek, The Secret Legacy of Coal in the Heartland. I mentioned that I was amazed at how long a history we have of coal mining in the United States, and I said to Jeff Biggers that although he mentions Thomas Jefferson, didn't it actually begin before then?
you know, it goes all the way back, of course, to the French who, you know, in the 1600s came into Illinois and discovered the Shawnee Indians and realized there was this black rock there. And they brought back a case back to France, and they brought a few Indians with them. And then from there, they really began to launch this whole industry. You know, I think Thomas Jefferson is the one who really went to England and discovered this great industrial revolution, you know, that a peck of coal could do more work than all these horses. And it's he who, in fact, came back and really began to launch it.
Why were the nation's first strip mines created in Illinois? Why not just do it the way it was done elsewhere and traditionally?
Well, just because the outcroppings were so close to the surface. I mean, you literally could see the coal. And in Eagle Creek in particular, we had very high outcroppings, and so you didn't need to go into these deep underground mines. My grandfather would go 800 feet deep into a mine in his area, but in many of these surface mines, the coal is right there, so it was much cheaper for the companies, certainly not cheaper for the region, but cheaper for the companies just to rake the coal off that way.
Now, coal is also tied up with the labor movement in America. And when I was a kid, John L. Lewis was one of the most recognizable figures because of his incredible eyebrows and his amazing way with the language. If I remember correctly, he's from Iowa, but he did mine in Illinois, didn't he?
Yeah, and that's really where he got his beginnings as a United Mine Worker. In fact, he's buried in the same cemetery there in Springfield as Abe Lincoln is. He was from Cleveland, Iowa, and just were there actually last week. But my grandfather, who was a United Mine Worker and then worked for the Progressive Miners of America, another renegade mine worker that broke off and that very much lionized people like Mother Jones, who's buried in southern Illinois, really made it very close to me and very important to me that the mine workers are the people who struggle for a real sense of not only workplace safety and equality, but social justice for our whole country. You know, it was integrated from day one. You know, they had an 8-hour workday as early as the 1870s. They were the people who were really opening up a real sense of workplace justice, not only for their industry, but all the industries in the country.
You mentioned Mother Jones. Most people think she's the person who lent her name to a magazine.
Very true. And here's this, of course, wonderful Irish woman who was working in Chicago, just down the road where Mr. Peabody was making all his millions with his coal mines. And she was absolutely outraged. And she went on to become the great miner's angel. She led so many strikes, of course, in West Virginia and across the country, even down in Mexico, up until the age of 100. But when she was about ready to pass on, she said, I want to be buried in the southern Illinois hills down by Mount Olive, because that's really where the radical militant factions were. And, of course, it's a cemetery that was protected by my grandfather's union.
You mentioned the Progressive Miners of America. Why did they break off? Why was there the equivalent of a union war between them and the United Mine Workers?
Unfortunately, in the 1930s, as the Depression hit, there were some hard choices. And John L. Lewis, of course, who was a wonderful tyrant, made some deals in the back rooms that a lot of the rank and file didn't like. He was not only cutting their contracts, but he was agreeing to move on with certain contracts. There was an election that the locals felt that there was fraud. And so there in central and southern Illinois, this new Progressive Miners of America took off. The union itself fizzled really by the 1950s, but it provided a progressive alternative for many decades.
Hadn't there been attempts to break either of those unions over the years?
Yeah, you know, for the most part, the United Mine Workers represents a tiny part of the coal miners today. And that, to me, is really one of the great tragedies. Virtually all the accidents we've had in the last years are in non-union mines. The Crandall Canyon disaster, of course, in Utah, which was absolutely tragic, was a non-union mine. You know, still today, Leonard, three coal miners die daily from black lung disease. You know, we diagnosed black lung in 1831, but we did nothing until we had this great labor movement in the 1960s. But still today, because we don't have a real commitment to workplace safety, miners are really suffering, and we need the union for that.
Don't the accidents and the black lung actually occur a lot more with underground mines than with strip mining?
Yeah, although you'd be surprised. Actually, last year, more people died at surface mines than underground mines because they have these huge machines, of course. And there's all sorts of accidents and people falling and crashing and whatnot. I think 26 people died, if I'm not mistaken, last year with strip mining.
Uh-huh. Falling into the, or just being hit by the machines?
Yeah, and backing up and, you know, all sorts of things you can imagine with these massive drag lines and these massive bulldozers.
So you're critical, but what about the other people in the area? Do they want coal mining to continue because it provides jobs and keeps the local economy thriving, or would they rather see it go?
You know, we are ready for a coal-free future. We're ready for a just transition in the coal fields. And that's just not myself, but that includes relatives of mine who are still in the coal industry, because the coal industry does not provide jobs. It's really one of the great mythologies that I'm trying to debunk. For every one strip miner job you have today, you've already lost two or three underground mining jobs. And in fact, the coal industry is one of those boom-bust industries that comes and goes. In Illinois, for example, we peaked in 1918. And so we've had this stranglehold. Coal mining keeps out any kind of sustainable economy, any kind of diversification of the economy. And so, you know, here we are in Saline County, Southern Illinois, for example, and we have some of the highest rates of poverty and the worst health care and the ailing health crisis. And that even though billions and billions of dollars have been trained and trucked out of our region, you know, the coal industry ultimately keeps us poor. And I think these people want a just transition and to have a fair share of this new clean energy economy.
Well, maybe things will change if some people in Washington and some people in environmental groups have their way and we switch to natural gas, which is less polluting. But then I just heard a report on NPR the other day which suggests that the people who are near the natural gas fields are just as upset about the possibility of their areas being ruined as the people in the coal areas are.
Right. And in particular here in New York, the fracking in upstate is a horrendous scenario for you, even breaking into.
So what do we do? Coal right now still remains the most reliable source of energy. The alternative some people have suggested, like President Obama when he was running, is so-called clean air.
Yeah.
Clean coal.
Right. You know, coal provides 45% of our electricity, and there's no silver bullet to replace coal, but there's a great smorgasbord of alternatives. Last year, we had a 39% increase in our wind potential. You know, Secretary Salazar, head of the Interior, said if we just began with offshore wind, we could really reduce our dependency on coal-fired plants. Every day, we're having breakthroughs in the solar industry. Google wants to go with geothermal. Other people down in Atlanta and Georgia are doing biochar and biomass conversion. There are so many options. And I think first and foremost, as everybody knows, if we had a true energy efficiency and weatherization program, we could cut consumption by anywhere from 25 to 30%.
Well, would we be able to get enough power from geothermal? I mean, we can't really get enough from hydroelectric energy sources to power things, so that's why we've depended on coal all these years.
But once again, it's not the silver bullet that replaces coal. It's different things we bring together, 25% here, 20% there, and I think this kind of decentralization and diversification is what we want. Secretary Chu, you know, who's head of the Department of Energy, he's wonderful because he said we have to have a revolutionary way of thinking. We need to start thinking out of the box and not feeling as if there's really the 19th century approach to energy.
My guest is Jeff Biggers, whose latest book is Reckoning at Eagle Creek, The Secret Legacy of Coal in the Heartland, published by Nation Books. Did the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act of 1977 improve the condition of the land after mining operations were complete?
It made the regulation a bit stricter, but the truth is it really launched the great tragedy for us, and that's mountaintop removal. Because when Jimmy Carter signed the SMCRA, the Surface Mining Control Act, he basically said this is a watered-down bill, and he wasn't happy with it because it gave federal sanctioning to the destructions of the mountains of Appalachia that today, as we're sitting here, 3 million pounds of explosives, the equivalent of several Hiroshima bombs, are dropped every month in Appalachia to blow up the mountains and then come in and scoop out the last little skinny seams of coal. And this is ultimately allowed under the Surface Mining Act, and it's being tolerated by the Obama administration.
Do they just dig into the mountain or blow the whole mountain apart?
They literally blow it up. They dump it into the valley. They have sullied 2,000 miles of streams and river, completely blocked them and destroyed them with toxins and pollutions. And then they bring in these massive bulldozers to load it up and then truck it out.
What does the landscape look like after a mountaintop has been removed?
it really looks like a lunar expanse. It's absolutely unthinkable. I think everybody should go to Google and put in mountaintop removal and look at the images. There are so many photos and films. It's, I think, if Americans really knew that this was taking place, that the energy in New York was coming from blowing up mountains, that we would stop it immediately. And the worst part, Leonard, is that it only provides 8% of our coal production in the country. You know, it's a drop in the bucket of what we could easily get from Wyoming.
And what happens to the soil that is dispersed
right.
as part of this explosion?
It's just dumped into the valleys. And, of course, this leads to massive erosion and flooding. And it really has ruined the life for people throughout Appalachia and the central Appalachian coal fields.
You're right about the Coal River Mountain. What happened there?
Coal River Mountain, for us, is really the line in the sand, because there, coal mining communities were targeted for a 6,000-acre mountaintop removal mine that would completely have destroyed their lives. And more importantly, there's the largest coal slurry impoundment, this huge toxic lake way up in the mountains, and they're blasting within 200 feet. And if the earthen dam of that coal slurry impoundment breaks, the people who live below, about 1,000 people, including an elementary school, would have 4 minutes to flee a 72-foot tidal wave of coal slurry. And so it's nuts what's going on. And so the local community came together, worked with experts, and found out that Coal River Mountain, the last intact mountain, has an incredible wind current. And they came up with this brilliant concept and actually found a plan and an engineer for an industrial wind farm that would have provided more tax revenues, more jobs over a 20-year period, and enough more energy for 150,000 households. Plus, they could have saved their communities for a future. And instead, the mountaintop removal mine is only going to provide coal for 14 years and will completely destroy the forest and the communities and the waterways.
And you say that it doesn't matter whether there's a Democrat or a Republican in the White House, this thing continues?
It continues today.
Didn't Barack Obama talk about changing things? What happened?
You know, he did, but he's unable to confront the stranglehold of the big coal companies. I think there's I wrote a piece today saying, what's the matter with my Midwestern Democrats and coal? I think there's a nostalgia. There's a misperception. They don't truly understand what's happening in the front lines of the coal fields. And mountaintop removal, which is easily the most egregious human rights and environmental violation in our country, is tolerated by the Obama administration, and they want to regulate it, Leonard. They don't want to abolish it. For some reason, they're afraid to take on big coal. And I think there's this new generation that says, we've had it, we've had enough, we want to be part of the clean energy future, and we're ready to take on big coal.
So you're saying that mountaintop removal is even worse than underground mining or strip mining, surface mining?
Yes. I find they're both deadly. Coal is incredibly deadly, both underground and above ground. But mountaintop removal has led to mass relocations of American citizens. It's completely poisoned the watersheds of the headwaters of some of the southeastern areas and drinking water. And it has really led to one of the worst environmental nightmares we have in the southeastern states.
What's the Illinois Coal Revival Program?
You know, our coal industry collapsed in 1990 because we had acid rain up here in New York, of course, in New England. And acid rain came from sulfur dioxide emissions that sprinkled on these trees and ruined them. And, of course, Illinois has very high sulfur coal. And so when we finally, and we knew about sulfur dioxide emissions in 1861, of course, and did nothing until 1990. And so when we finally passed the Clean Air Act, the Illinois coal industry collapsed for the most part because it couldn't compete with the low sulfur up in Wyoming. And so there was.
This is like petroleum, where some kinds of grades of petroleum from Nigeria, for example, are easier to refine than stuff from other places, and so they are valued higher.
Exactly, and you know, not all coal is the same. You know, you have different types of coal. But there was still this lingering, this nostalgia of bringing back the coal industry. And so we have been pouring millions, if not billions, of our American taxpayer dollars, both in Illinois and nationwide, to give subsidies to the coal companies, who meanwhile are turning massive profits, to try to revamp and then do this kind of chimera, this completely fanciful idea of carbon capture and storage.
So Illinois still has a lot of coal that right now is not being mined?
Illinois has 38 billion tons of coal, but there's one little catch. Is it's incredibly deep and it's incredibly dirty, and it's not economically feasible to get that. And that's one little reality that we're not talking about, is we're reaching peak coal because it's just too dirty and down to get right now.
What do you think about carbon capture and sequestration? which is known as clean coal.
Right. I think it's really the new bridge to nowhere, you know, and I've studied it very closely. Of course, a young man named Francis Peabody in the 1890s came down from Chicago and he took out ads for smoke-free clean coal. And we've been seeing ads for clean coal for a century. Whenever the coal industry had an image problem, they'd trot out clean coal. Sulfur dioxide emissions, clean coal. And so what they're doing now is trying to convince us that this fanciful technology, that we're going to capture the carbon emissions, which create 40% of our global warming problem in the country, we're somehow going to be able to bury them. But not one scientist can come onto your program and tell us that it's technologically feasible within the next 10 to 20 years, that it's not economically prohibitive, but more importantly, it's going to increase coal production and devastate our communities.
We only have 15 seconds left, but what's your take on the American Clean Energy and Security Act, known as Waxman-Markey Bill?
I think it's a good first step, but it needs to have a much more aggressive look at stopping the subsidies for the coal industry and shifting our coal fields to a clean energy future.
The book, Reckoning at Eagle Creek, The Secret Legacy of Coal in the Heartland, published by Nation Books. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
On Monday's show, former First Lady Rosalynn Carter discusses the current state of mental health care in America. Then Pam Grier on her life and a career that's been filled with many memorable roles like Jackie Brown. Also, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein on her controversial new novel, 36 Arguments for the Existence of God. And Timothy Ferris examines the links between science and democracy. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blake Lee Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Eakin is the executive producer, and we had help today from Peggy Bullis-Smith, Shepard Laughlin, and contributing producers Barbara Kahn and Virginia Doris. Dimitri Krasny was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening. Have a great 4th of July, and we'll see you on Monday.